Not really. I hit him, Laura said. Tim snorted. You've got to understand. I really connected with this kid. The interviews must have run 100 hours. And then this piece of shit tells the kid that he's the one going to hell. So it was a crime of passion. BPD didn't charge me, but he sued me in the paper. He would have won, too, but he offered the Globe a bargain. He didn't want money. Just your head on a platter, Tim said. She shrugged. Can you blame them? I punched the subject of an investigative report. People have been fired for less. There's right and there's wrong. And then there's playing the game. I should have played it safe and just forgotten about the whole thing. That's the lesson you took away from it all? Absolutely. Okay, he said and stood up from the booth. We're done here. He left $5 on the table and walked out. He didn't speak a word on the ride back, didn't open his mouth for the first 5 minutes parked in the motel lot, engine idling, air conditioning set to Arctic freeze. Laura broke first. So that was a deal breaker. He didn't look at her, just stared at the motel office through mirrored sunglasses. You've got a temper, he said. And that's given me pause. Plus, it sounds like getting fired really screwed up your moral compass. She snorted. Like cops have a monopoly on morality. He slipped off the shades and fixed her with those near colorless eyes. Of course not. In fact, there's more psychos in the bunch than average. Something about the power and the guns attracts them. But this kind of work attracts all types. Some people see the injustice in the world and it just bothers them. Like an itch they can't scratch. So they become cops and scratch away at things. Boy, Tim, that's a real down-home country way of saying you're the arbiter of right and wrong, that you get to decide what part of the world needs fixing. I do indeed, he said. I didn't ask to be this way. Blame my mama. She did a damn fine job of raising me, and deciding what's right and what's wrong has never been my problem. He tapped his chest. I already know. I've known since I was a boy. Laura stared at him. There was something incredibly old-fashioned about Tominski's worldview, like he'd stepped out of one of her father's westerns. And if he was a cowboy, maybe he knew how to barter. She said it quietly. I know something about the case. Maybe I can help you find him.
Let me guess. You want something in return.
Yes. She forced the word out. It made her skin feel oily. Tominski didn't look surprised.
Okay, then. Let's have it.
I help you. You help me. We trade.
You could just tell me what you know and hope it helps, he said.
She kept her mouth shut, and finally he nodded.
We trade, but I get to assign the value of this so-called vital clue.
She had nothing but his word, but then again, what else could she hope to get? Her back was against the wall, and this was the only play. It was time to take a chance. She walked him through her exploration of the crime scene, climbing the ridge in darkness, finding the recessed ledge. At the end, he said,
That's good. You can take me there.
Now? He looked up at the sun.
In a few hours, I have things to do, and in the meantime, maybe some of this heat will burn off.
It would only get hotter throughout the day, the humidity closing in like a wet blanket. But she didn't correct him.
This can work for both of us, he said, but I need us to see eye to eye.
I won't be a mouthpiece, just printing whatever you tell me to print. I need enough agency to present the story as I see it.
I don't expect to line edit what you write, but I do call the shots. If I ask you to include a specific detail in a story, I need you to do that. If I tell you something's off the record, or ask you to hold back key facts of the investigation, I expect you to honor those requests. And if you burn me on this, well, I don't think your career can take two black eyes.
He paused.
Do you?
He shut off the engine and climbed out, headed toward his motel room.
Lara followed him out onto the scorching blacktop and caught up with him in the shade under the strip of roof covering the doors. "Why work with me at all?" she asked. "Until we know who he is, the press might be the only way to reach him. And if we can reach him, we can flush him into the open." He wiped his brow with the back of one hand. "And because I know you, Lara. I am you. Recognize my accent?" She shook her head. "Tennessee born and bred. Hill people stock. I remember being desperate to get out of there. Joining the FBI, that was the dream. And it almost didn't happen. I made a mistake, a big one. Pulled my service weapon when I shouldn't have. Pulled the trigger when I shouldn't have. Very lucky no one got hurt. It could have ended my career. But someone higher up took pity on me and smoothed it over." Lara said nothing. "And I asked him that same question," Tominski continued. "Why me? Why bet on someone who just exposed themselves as incapable? You know what he said? He said, 'Tim, the dog that lost the fox is twice as eager to please.' He was sure as hell right about that." "I'm not a dog," Lara said. "You're missing the complexity of it. It just occurs to me that you might be the type of person who understands the value of a second chance, and who will be careful not to waste it. I could reach out to the News and Observer in Raleigh, or to some other reporter at the Gazette. But you won't. No, I suspect you'll work twice as hard as anyone else." Chapter 8. If some mad scientist had stapled together three normal-sized people, the end result would have been close to Diane Chambers. Curls upon curls of hair blown out daily, costume jewelry dripping down her chins, muumuus sewn to look like shapeless prom dresses. Diane weighed more than 300 pounds and spoke with a Texas twang despite never having traveled more than 100 miles from Hillsboro. Lara came in through the kitchen door. Her mother spent 12 hours a day sleeping, and the other 12 fastened to a Barker lounger in the living room. The kitchen served only a staging area for old pizza boxes and slimy dishes. Today, though, the one oversized kitchen chair was occupied. "Oh, no." Diane clapped her hands together, flabby arms trembling in their own personal earthquake. "Have you been fired again?" "I make my own hours, Diane."
"Don't call me that."
Her voice combined the worst parts of a wet cough and a leaf blower, a rumbling, phlegmy shriek that set Lara's teeth on edge. "That's your name, isn't it?"
"Call me Mama."
"I think I stopped calling you Mama in the second grade."
"You did, you did."
Diane nodded, her chins bouncing.
"Such a thankless child, always with that sour look on your face. Bring me a glass of water, would you, dear? You owe me that much."
Lara sifted through the dusty glasses in the cabinet, located the cleanest, filled it with tap water, and set it on the table. The old farmhouse lacked any kind of air conditioning. The kitchen didn't even have a fan. Her mother looked like she was about to melt away into a pool of blubber. Diane slurped the water down in three quick gulps and ran a hand over her bloated lips.
"Why can't you be a good girl like this all the time? I swear, the good Lord put you on this earth to test me."
"It shouldn't be a surprise that raising a child is what follows having a child. You chose to have me."
"Not alone."
Diane pressed a hand over her undoubtedly oversized heart.
"Your father abandoned me."
"By dying? I'm sure he did it just for spite." Her mother frowned.
"I wouldn't be shocked."
Lara remembered her father's funeral. 8 years old, and devastated to learn firsthand that a person can simply cease to be. Those were long, empty days in the house without him. She could remember rarely speaking for the first few months. Her mother, on the other hand, had devoured the attention, consuming hugs and condolence cards as heartily as the casseroles and pies delivered to their door. She wore black for nearly a year, summoned crocodile tears often in public, and complained endlessly about her dead husband at home. It galled her that he'd had the audacity to die. She hated him for it.
Laura found her mother's behavior disgusting, which in turn made her feel like a hypocrite. She hated her father, too. After all, he had left her alone with Diane.
Probably he saw what a little bitch you were turning into and took the easy way out, Diane said.
Despite herself, Laura felt dampness at the corners of her eyes. She was 29 years old, but her mother could still make her cry.
Oh, now you're gonna blubber? Don't blame me, girl. I'm just truth-telling. The man was a coward, too yellow to raise a child. A child is a responsibility, Laura. Not like you'd know yourself.
Long experience had taught her to say nothing, to ignore the barbs and just leave.
But at least you'll never have to know the pain I know,
her mother continued.
The pain of having your own child embarrass you.
Laura couldn't believe it. Through middle and high school, her mother had stopped leaving the house entirely. She still had a circle of ladies she called on the phone, fishing for gossip, but none of them visited her, and she never ventured out. Laura had made excuses for her all those years, never bringing friends to the house, ashamed to let them see the woman who'd raised her. The words were out of her mouth before she could stop them.
Me? Embarrass you? How? For God's sake, Laura, you made such a stink about leaving Hillsboro all high and mighty. I could have lived with that. Plenty of people in this town need to be taken down a peg or two. But to come back here with your tail between your legs?
Her mother drained the last bit of water, then spit it back into the glass.
It would have been better if you died.
Maybe it would have been, Laura muttered.
I see. Now you're going to play the martyr, right on schedule. Don't think I forgot your tricks, girl.
Laura shook her head. I only tried to do the right thing.
Must not have tried very hard. We're the town punchline because of you. I can hear it in people's voices on the phone. They're all laughing at us behind our back.
Laughing at you, maybe.
Oh, Laura, it's as though you forgot all the lessons I tried to teach you. You were supposed to do great things. I didn't raise no ordinary girl, but that's what you are now. Plain. Homely. Just another dull piece of ass for the boys to play with.
Mama, no, don't call me that. I'm not sure I still want a daughter.
Laura turned to go. That's right, leave. Just leave me here all alone. All you'll do is prove my point, that you're a good for nothing, that you're a stain this family can't wash out. I wish you'd just disappear.
Laura left. In her room, she took deep breaths until she was sure the tears wouldn't come. Then she put on her boots, filled a bag with clothes and other essentials, and left through the front door. From the front yard, she could still hear the raving, cries like knives cutting through the air. As she walked away, the invective turned to indistinct shouting and guttural moans. She couldn't make out a single word her mother said, which was exactly how she liked it. Chapter 9.
Hold up a second,
Tominski said, and stopped climbing. He perched on a rocky outcropping and ran a handkerchief across the top of his head, wicking away the sweat. It didn't seem to do him much good. 3 in the afternoon, and the humidity was in full bloom. The sun hung in the sky like a white-hot coal, and the ridge line didn't offer much cover. Laura looked up and tried to gauge the distance. It's not much farther now, just another 100 yards or so. Under her breath, she added, I hope. It was the daylight disorienting her. Everything looked different in the absence of shadows. Last night, all she could see existed in the narrow tunnel of her flashlight. Now there were more landmarks than she could count, most of them unfamiliar.
Reminds me of taking the FBI physical.
Getting down was the tricky part. It was dark.
You scared to be back up here?
She shook her head.
Don't fib. Why are you still trying to be a reporter?
He held out his hand and she took it, pulling him to his feet. We're not as similar as you seem to think we are, Tim.
No, every man's an island, like that.
I just mean we don't know each other well enough for you to say we're the same.
Talk about a double-edged sword. If that's true, Maybe we're exactly the same, and you don't know me well enough to realize it. By the way, one of us reads people for a living.
I thought law enforcement was about, you know, collecting evidence, fingerprints and fibers, witness statements, confessions, all that.
Sure, of course. But the purpose of collecting all that is so it can be presented in court, so some DA can get a conviction.
And that's not important?
More than important. It's what makes the whole thing a worthwhile endeavor. It's the cheese at the end of the maze. But that's just the beginning and the end.
Laura didn't understand that. She said so.
The beginning and the end. He kept climbing. You start with a crime scene. You collect evidence. You end with a suspect. Collect evidence again. Match the two up, you see? But the middle. Boy, that's the tricky part. Hell of a job finding one person hiding among all the other people in the world.
You mean they don't usually drop their driver's license next to the body?
He laughed, a hard, short bark. Not in my experience. The middle of a case is all instinct. Following your gut. Reading people. With enough practice, you start to get a feel for how each type of crime flows.
Flows, she repeated.
Water takes the path of least resistance. People are no different.
He stopped and scanned the ground ahead.
Which way?
In front of them stood a stand of scrubby pines she didn't recognize. Laura put a hand on Tominski's shoulder and moved past him, climbed up into the pines, and spotted the rocky outcropping level with their position. She pointed. Right there. Tominski followed as she crabbed across the face of the ridge, twice almost slipping and falling due to the loose rocky surface. The cave, as she'd come to think of it, was quite a bit more disappointing in the daylight. Last night, the walls had extended back several yards, and she had been unable to rule out the possibility of some tunnel burrowing deeper into the earth. Now it stood revealed, little more than a 3-foot depression set under a slight overhang. Still, the leafy brush in front of it made it an ideal hiding place. Tominski scrambled up next to her and turned around.
Will you look at that? Perfect vantage of the dump site.
Is that what you call it?
Sorry, inelegant phrasing, I know, but that's what we call it. She wasn't killed there. Someone placed her out in that field.
I heard, Laura said. She followed his gaze out into the soybeans. The muddy track still ended in the middle, and from there, she could trace her way to the exact spot Olive Hansen's body had been placed. She shivered in the heat.
You've got another law enforcement contact.
The statement caught her off guard, and she almost confirmed it. He squatted down and examined the slab of rock under their feet.
So where are they?
Laura turned 360 degrees, searching the ground. No cigarette butts. Then she saw one caught in a crack. There. He pulled it out with a pair of tweezers and dropped it into a plastic bag. They looked at it together. That's the same one, I'm sure of it.
How many did you say were up here?
More than 5, fewer than 10. I didn't count. Maybe the wind took the rest. He nodded, then made a cursory search of the ground on either side of the rocks. Nothing to see.
Maybe,
he said.
But really, the only direction the wind can come from is directly in front of us, which would just blow them up against the wall. I suppose the wind could cut along the ridgeline, but the direction still isn't right. They should be here.
Meaning what? He said nothing.
You mean someone picked them up?
But why the one left in the crack?
They missed it. It happens.
But it only took us a few seconds to spot it.
Sure, in the daylight. If they were here at sunset and gone today, maybe they were collected during the night.
Laura's weight shifted under her, as though the ground were suddenly on a ship's deck lurching side to side. She leaned back against the rock and closed her eyes. That would mean we were up here together.
Not necessarily. It could have been after you left.
Laura thought back to her trudge to the center of the field, to standing in the green and looking back towards the ridge, to the electric feeling in the air.
Not after, she said.
Tominski pushed himself up, pressed his back into the depression, and looked down again.
He was here.
he said, almost to himself. Laura shook off her chill, stepped off the rock.
What makes you so sure it's a he?
Statistics, which isn't the same thing as being sure.
What does that say about men?
Nothing good, he said. This is the hardest part. I may be good at reading people, but sitting across from someone, looking them in the eye, that's a whole different thing than sitting on a ridge looking at a field.
So you're saying you haven't solved it yet? That earned her a wry smile.
No, not yet. That thing I said before about the flow of a crime. The flow is weakest in ones like this. It's usually not so difficult to connect point A to point B. A wife dies, look to the husband. A husband dies, look to the wife. Find out who loves, who hates, who inherits. Murder isn't complicated. Quite the opposite. It's very, very old and very, very simple. Most of the time.
But for a serial killer,
he cut her off. One body does not a serial killer make.
Two girls taken, she countered.
Even if Teresa Mitchum was dead, it still wouldn't be enough.
That doesn't sound like you denying this is a serial killer. Tominski fixed her with that flat blue gaze.
This is one of those times where we need to be explicit. Are we off the record?
Anytime you say we're off, we're off. He nodded.
Okay, yes. Whether he is a serial killer or not will ultimately depend on the number of victims. I think what you're really asking is, did a stranger do this? Did a man pick these girls out and then take them for motives that are hard to put succinctly into words? Is that it?
That's it.
Tominski shrugged. My gut says yes. Could have been a relative, a father or an uncle, being inappropriate with one of the girls. Things get out of hand. He kills Olive Hansen. Then he tries to make it look like something else. Get us off the scent.
Laura was ashamed to admit she had never considered the killer to be anything but an outsider, a person unknown to his victims.
Is that possible? She asked.
Anything is possible at this point. But we've eliminated all the relatives. Some can't account for their time when the girls were taken, and some can't account for when Olive Hansen was placed in that field. But make a Venn diagram of the two groups, and there's no overlap.
Maybe it's more than one person.
Sure, it could be, he said. But look where we've wandered off to. Now we've got two relatives working in tandem, two secret predators who've managed to stay hidden all these years. Call it a gut feeling. Call it playing the odds. But it doesn't seem likely, does it?
Laura shook her head.
And there's something else. I'm going to ask one more time. We're off the record?
Of course.
Olive Hansen wasn't sexually assaulted.
It rocked Laura back a step. Again, new information challenged the very specific picture of the perpetrator she had in her mind. He was a stranger. A person who did what he did out of some sick sexual need. But if he hadn't even touched her.
You're sure?
Fairly certain.
What does fairly certain mean? He did or he didn't?
He washed the body.
So you can't tell?
Laura, the, sorts of things you're thinking of.
He coughed into his hand.
It would have left physiological evidence. Tearing and such.
Laura swallowed hard. She could hear it behind her ears.
But there was nothing like that. The cause of death was strangulation. Other than the marks on her neck, it's like he never touched her.
That's good, she said softly. He shook his head.
This sounds horrible, but in terms of finding this prick, no, that's not good. Sexual assault would have narrowed the profile. The chance of finding physical evidence would have increased. And even if we didn't find anything, at least we would have had a clearer idea of the type of person we're hunting. Instead, all we've done is muddy the waters.
So what does that leave? Tell me about the profile you do have.
Off the record.
Christ, Tim, I want to help you, I really do. But are you planning to give me anything I can print?
Bureau would never let me leak the profile from an ongoing investigation.
Fine, fine. Off the record.
Off the record. A relative doesn't make any sense. No one is unaccounted for. Besides, other than the obvious, which we've ruled out. What motive does a family member have to kill a 10-year-old? The same goes for strangers.
So what are you thinking?
That he stood here and watched us down there with the body.
She waited.
That's it, he said. That's the profile. He washed her, posed her, left her to be found. Then he watched us mill around and look at her.
So he returned to the scene of the crime. Lots of criminals do that.
Sure. But this whole setting,
Tominski gestured to the ridge in the field.
It seems designed to facilitate him watching us.
Could be he wanted to get a look at you. Keep tabs on the enemy.
Tominski stared off into space, tapped one finger against his front tooth.
Maybe.
Come on, give me something that's fit to print.
Well, the truth is that the Bureau would never let me reveal anything about an active investigation. Period.
Laura narrowed her eyes. You better be going somewhere with this. We had a deal.
Nope. I'm afraid I can't tell you a thing about this case on the record. Not while it's open.
Tim, but, he cut her off.
There's really nothing preventing me from telling you about cases that are closed.
What? Why would I care? I didn't climb up here just to talk about old cases.
What year were you born?
It doesn't matter.
File on you said 29. So, 1988, right?
Yes, but
interesting year, 1988. Interesting all over, but especially here in Hillsboro. I don't suppose you remember much about it.
No, Tim, I was an infant.
Didn't read the paper much then?
Her face started to flush. I'm being serious. We had a deal, and it was a deal about this investigation, this crime. I don't want to talk about 1988.
He shook his head. I beg to differ, Laura. I think you're going to want to hear this.
Chapter 10. An unnamed source in law enforcement, or a source close to the investigation. That's how Tim had asked to be credited, at least publicly. Privately, though, he'd given his blessing to be discreetly named. His credentials plus the three letters of his agency would open a lot of doors. It would make writing the story easier, and he needed her story to succeed. Perhaps later she could refer to him by name in print. But for now, the weight and authority of a simple unnamed cop would have to be enough. Besides, if everything he'd hinted at was true, the source would be the last thing on anyone's mind. The Orange County Library building had moved to a modish brick and glass building while she was away, but the back of the main hall still had a roll of microfilm readers. August 1988 started out the same as January. The first few Gazette front pages featured headlines like Orange High Panthers Thrash Chapel Hill and Heavy Rains Delay Churton Construction. On August 5th, things changed. Laura reached out and touched the screen, ran her finger across the picture they'd printed. The headline read, Gilroy Girls Search Continues. And the picture was Olive Hansen, rendered in black and white. Laura double-checked the caption, confirming that this was indeed Susan Gilroy. Looking at the photograph was like looking at a ghost. Corn silk blonde hair, a narrow face ending in a weak chin, sad eyes. A face that had seen violence and come to accept it, one that expected every adult was 2 seconds away from lashing out with a slap or a kick. The face of a little girl who had decided to pursue a strategy of blending into the background, hoping never to be noticed. A child who excelled at remaining invisible. Susan Gilroy appeared to have done this so successfully, all the color had drained out of her. She reminded Laura of homeschooled children, the ones who were never allowed out into the sunlight, and turned nearly albino as a result. And the eyes. Cold eyes for a 9-year-old. She stared straight out from the grainy photo like she was asking for something. Or waiting for something. Laura pushed on through headlines screaming about the search, the discovery of the body, the subsequent failed investigation. After 2 months, the coverage started to falter. Articles moved to the second page, then onto the third. Soon it was mentioned only in follow-ups once a week. Then it happened again. Another 9-year-old, Alina Scopolotto, disappeared on the night of October 31st. The irony of it being Halloween was lost on no one. And again, the body was returned. The Gazette was in war mode now, endless 40-point headlines, constant references to coverage in the Raleigh News and Observer and other dailies. The second killing had transformed a simple murder into something newsworthy on a national level. And even before the Alina Scopolotto feeding frenzy tapered off, another girl went missing. More grisly font splashed across the front page. Kid takes another girl. At first, the headline made no sense to her. A closer reading revealed something she'd missed while skimming. Between the second and third missing girl, this killer had been bestowed with that highest of honors, a nickname in the press. He'd joined the likes of the Zodiac, the Night Stalker, the Boston Strangler, the Midtown Slasher, the Alligator Man, Son of Sam, and Jack the Ripper. This name, though, seemed so innocuous as to be almost farcical. They were calling him the Kid. Laura kept reading, utterly transported. She had spent the first 18 years of her life in Hillsboro. How had she never heard about any of this? One name kept appearing again and again. Deputy Donald Rogers of the Orange County Sheriff's Office. He'd been lead investigator on the case and had been much more willing to talk to the reporters back in 1988 than Sheriff McKinney was today. He used the Gazette to appeal directly to citizens, asking them to come forward with any information. He even used it to address to the Kid, pleading for the return of the second missing girl, Alina Scopolotto. The Kid had responded with a corpse. Laura kept reading long enough to see the headline shrieking about the third girl, Maria Mendelson, age 10. There was a drudgery in reading about death. It made her tired. She rolled back the microfilm and watched them reappear in reverse order. Maria Mendelson, the Scopolotta girl, then little Susan Gilroy. Donald Rogers had gone on to be sheriff. Laura remembered him from her high school years. He'd personally broken up a drinking party on the Orange High baseball field late one Friday night. Hadn't handed out tickets, just gave everyone a stern talking to. Perhaps stern wasn't a strong enough word. She remembered several of the baseball players with tears in their eyes, crying as Rogers laid into them. He'd been kinder to the girls. A quick search of the phone book revealed that he was still alive and living 4 or 5 miles north of downtown, not too far from the Chambers farm. Laura thought about calling, then dismissed the idea. Why give up the element of surprise? She drove past the driveway twice before locating the address scrawled on a wooden post toppled into the ditch. It wasn't much more than a rutted clay track, and the Dart's muffler scraped the ground more than once on the way up to the sagging farmhouse. Laura climbed out of the car. The sun hung above the treetops, and the shadows lay stretched out like black oil. She took 3 steps across the front yard and stopped. A man emerged from a dark corner of the front porch, a shotgun carried loosely across his chest.
"Sign says no trespassing," he called.
"What sign?"
"One next to the damn address."
"The wooden post? It blew down into the ditch. That sign is long gone." Rogers had the same cowboy gait she remembered, as if he'd just spent a day on horseback, and the same liquid brown eyes. But his thin blonde hair had turned a dirty gray, and his face had changed. Time hadn't been kind. Deep crow's fit pitted his orbital sockets, and trenches etched the lines between his nose and the corners of his mouth. He looked sour as he came down the front steps, and it didn't help when he spit into the dirt.
"Well, I'm telling you then, no trespassing."
"Are you Donald Rogers?"
"Who's asking?" "I know you from somewhere."
"My name is Laura Chambers. I'm a reporter for the Gazette."
He squinted at her. "No, that's not it."
"I also went to high school around here. We never met exactly, but I do remember one time on the baseball field."
"Laura Chambers, of course. Headed north about as soon as you could, legally speaking."
She nodded.
"I remember you. I remember almost everyone I ever talked to.
The shotgun hadn't moved an inch, which Laura took as an encouraging sign. She started walking across the yard.
What about Susan Gilroy? Do you remember her?
Rogers froze up, and he let the shotgun barrel drop down next to his leg.
Now who mentioned that name to you?
An FBI agent named Tominski. People call him Tim.
Nope, don't know him. Like I said, I'd remember.
He's the FBI agent here because of Olive Hansen and Teresa Mitchum.
And he sent you to talk to me?
In a manner of speaking.
Rogers nodded to himself.
Figured someone would be along sooner or later. Didn't expect it to be a damn reporter. But if the FBI, he drew out each letter, sent you, I guess I'd better play along.
He stood back and let her walk up the stairs in front of him, then stepped past her and pulled open the screen door.
Mind the dog, he said. He don't bite.
Cooper pushed his nose into the back of her knee and gave a few long, careful snorts.
Cooper, get off the lady.
It's okay, Laura said.
He just wants to get your scent. Can't help himself. It's his nature.
Cooper huffed her a few more times, then lolled his tongue out and gave the back of her hand a lick. His ears drooped down nearly to the ground, and folds of skin covered most of his eyes.
Bloodhound? Laura asked.
Purebred. Used to really be something, but he's almost 12 years old now. Cooper's enjoying retirement.
And how about his owner?
That earned her a small smile.
After years of cleaning up other people's messes, I decided to buy this farm and move outside of town, and finally get some alone time with my wife. A golden pond kind of thing. Then she up and died, and I ended up with more alone time than I'd bargained for.
Sorry to hear it, Laura said.
Oh, hell, it's a ways back now.
You could move back to town.
Nope,
he shook his head.
Too stubborn.
At least you can admit it.
Admit it? I'm proud of it. I wish folks had more steel in them. Seems to me that at least half the people today can be swayed by a gentle breeze. Tempt a husband and he cheats on his wife. Pressure a child and he joins a gang. Pay a politician, and he'll do whatever the hell you tell him to. Things used to be different.
Really? The politicians used to be honest?
Another small smile.
Fair point. Maybe I'm remembering the good old days a little too good.
Laura smiled back. Maybe.
And you, Laura? I heard they kicked your ass out of Boston.
She grimaced.
Too soon?
She shook her head. Is there anyone in town who doesn't know about that?
Well, I know about it, and some people describe me as a hermit. No, I think it's safe to assume everyone within 100 miles has heard that particular story.
The thought entered her mind that her mother might, on some deluded level, have been right. It made Laura's head hurt. At moments like this, it wasn't hard to remember why she had left town in the first place. Rogers saw the look on her face.
Sorry to bring it up,
he said, and she waved him off. They sat at the dining room table, glasses of water untouched in front of them. The inside of the farmhouse was surprisingly neat and tidy, swept clean of any dust or clutter. Not what she would have expected from a bachelor.
So let's talk about trust, he said.
Go on.
As in, why should I trust you?
I guess mentioning the FBI doesn't get a girl far these days. He held up both hands.
Don't get me wrong, it's impressive. I served as sheriff for 8 years, and you've still met more FBI agents than I have. But that's the point, right? I don't know this Tominski. I've never talked about this case with anyone, and I'd be perfectly happy to leave things as they are. Why should I start digging up the past?
Laura leaned back, surprised.
So no one else ever came asking questions?
After the beginning of 1989? Nope.
Well, there you go, Don. He frowned at the use of his first name. I'm the only one who ever bothered to show up.
His eyebrows crept up his forehead.
I'm getting pretty old. Maybe you better lay that one on me again.
Laura unpacked her bag onto the table, laying out folders, papers, notebooks. It's like this. Maybe you retired to try and forget this kind of thing. Maybe even now you're planning to let me down easy. You'll let me talk a while before kicking me out, getting me out of your hair. Then you can go back to doing whatever you do out here all alone. You can go back to ignoring dead little girls and men with strong hands. He started to open his mouth. Laura raised a hand to stop him from talking. Maybe that's the kind of cop you are, the one who decides to cut bait, she continued. But maybe you're the other kind, the kind who tries to forget but can't, not in good conscience. If your conscience is nagging you, Don, I'm the only cure. I'm the only one who ever gave enough of a shit about those girls to get in my car, drive out to your farm, sit at your table, and ask you about them. So if you've got something to say, it's now or never. He paused.
Which do you think I am? Which kind?
She gestured around her, toward the houses and the surrounding fields. I think you tried to cut bait. Only it didn't work. The fish hook got caught in the back of your hand. It's still there, bothering you, begging you to itch at it.
Well, all right. Okay, then.
He sucked a tooth and considered her.
Tell me what you already know, and I can try to fill in a few blanks.
Laura fanned a series of photocopies out across the tabletop. I know about the three girls, Susan Gilroy, Alina Scopolotto, and Maria Mendelssohn. I know they were taken and killed, the bodies left in fields to be discovered later. I know the case bears a number of similarities to Olive Hansen.
So basically just what you read in the papers, he said.
Well, she looked down at her shoes. Rogers popped up from his seat and started pacing the room.
Christ, that's really all, isn't it? This Tominski character, he sent you in here half-cocked, you know that.
I read all the news coverage from back then, Laura protested. I read everything you ever said when you were sheriff.
I spent more time keeping things out of the papers than I ever spent putting things into them, girlie. We gave a lot of statements back then. We were a lot freer with information. It was a different time. But I never broadcast any details. If everything you know came from the papers, you don't know squat.
She felt anger bubble up in her chest. Oh, so you did have a suspect after all? He pointed a finger at her.
Don't make light of it. That case.
He said and stopped. What? The next words out of his mouth were so quiet she could barely hear them.
Do you really think there's a connection between what happened back then and these two little girls?
Laura took a deep breath. I think there's a connection, yes. I can't say why Agent Tominski sent me here without more information. Maybe he thinks I can help. Rogers studied her another few moments, his face scrunched up in confusion. Suddenly it cleared. He stopped pacing and grinned.
Aha,
he said. Laura said nothing.
I get it,
he said. What's to get?
This so-called connection. Tominski said it was fact, eh?
Not in so many words, no. He's a source, and he doesn't want all the facts to come straight from the horse's mouth. If he fed me everything, it could be traced back to him. Instead, if I do the footwork, go around collecting facts myself, I can cite those other sources and it will put him in the clear.
Oh, I bet it will.
He just pointed me in the right direction.
Rogers grinned again. Let me guess. He wants to be credited as an unnamed source in law enforcement.
Well, yes.
I think I may have invented that one.
She could feel her face turning red. You can wipe that look off your face. He pressed a hand to his chest.
What look?
The same one as the cat that ate the canary.
He's using you. Agent Tim, whatever his name is, he's going to have you prop up a theory.
Laura didn't know what that meant, and Rogers saw it in her face.
Girlie, didn't you learn anything up there in the big city? A place like Boston, I figured you would have been used enough times to get a feel for when someone's blowing smoke up your ass. In fact, he said, considering her again, I'm sure you did. This agent fella must be a real smooth cookie.
Okay, I'll bite. What's propping up a theory?
It's a little trick in law enforcement. Say there's a direction you want to take an investigation. A suspect you want to sweat. A location you want to stake out. But the evidence doesn't quite justify it. Doesn't really matter, since a gut feeling is the only thing a cop needs. He paused, took a swig of his drink. The good ones, anyway.
And you were a good one.
I'm sure it didn't seem like it, me spending time chasing you kids off that baseball field. Not exactly glamorous.
You were just doing your job, she said.
And if that was the totality of my job, making sure kids don't break arbitrary rules, I wouldn't blame you for thinking less of me. But we did have a few actual crimes when I was sheriff, most of them solved by me. It wasn't like working homicide in a major metro area, but I spent my fair share of time out near the limits of human nature. I was pretty proficient out there, too. Always had a feeling about the bad ones.
And this specific bad one?
We'll get to it, okay? But he's having you prop him up, Miss Chambers. No doubt in my mind. If you're a lead investigator, and you find yourself in the situation I just described, the thing to do is find a nice young reporter and take them under your wing.
Take them under your wing. He said it with about as much sarcasm as possible.
Feed them a juicy story, anonymously, of course, and let them go public with it. The juicier the story, the better it works. The public is outraged. They demand something be done. Soon enough, the boys in elected office start shaking in their boots, and word comes down from on high. Sweat that suspect, Rogers, and stake out that address. He grinned again. And I would always hang my head a little, like I had weekend plans that just got torpedoed, and say, "Yes, sir, if you insist, sir."
Lara's mouth hung open. He sipped some more water.
Never failed.
Look, I'm not unfamiliar with the police using the press, and vice versa for that matter. But Tominski seems like a straight shooter.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
And besides, we're both on the same side. I want a story that gets this guy caught. Tominski wants him caught. So what if he's using me to put a little pressure on his superiors?
Well, what if he's wrong?
I don't follow.
What if he's wrong, and this so-called connection turns out to be complete and utter horseshit, and you print it on the front page with your name right next to it for everyone to see? He's insulated, right? You can't reveal him as a source, and he's sure as hell not going to reveal himself as a source. You'll take the fall alone.
She tapped her pen against the table. Rogers put on a convincing show. Could Tim really be using her like that? She remembered her sins against Frank and grimaced. No one was immune to the people they trusted.
Maybe, she said finally. Take my word for it, Miss Chambers. This story is a trial balloon, and you're riding in the balloon.
I'll think about it. He studied her for a moment, taking the measure of his guest.
Considering what I just told you, that this whole thing might be a wild goose chase dangerous enough to end your career, do you still want to hear what I have to say?
She didn't hesitate. Absolutely. He smiled for the third time.
Guess that means you're worth talking to. Let's go back to my den.
Chapter 11. The den squatted in the house's northeast corner and received little afternoon sun. Heavy blinds cut off what light managed to sneak around from the west. Boxes stacked five high ran along every wall.
I knew you didn't leave this behind, Lara said.
Rogers shrugged and pushed himself down into a chair in front of a cluttered credenza.
What gave me away?
You mean, besides the kind of pathology that makes a man keep all this paperwork? Call it a gut feeling. Journalists have them, too. He guffawed.
Yeah, usually they have a gut instinct for self-preservation.
Her shoulder slumped. I can't deny that.
Oh, hey.
He reached out like he wanted to pat her shoulder, then thought better of it and let his arms hang awkwardly at his sides.
I didn't mean you.
Don't worry about it. He nodded.
Okay, so the wall behind you next to the door, That's all 1988.
Her eyes widened. I thought you might have trouble letting go, that you'd hang on to a lot of files. But that's all 1988?
I only kept the ones I couldn't forget about.
Her eyes moved up and down the rows, surveying the boxes. Even if you wanted to forget, looks like there'd be a hell of a lot to unload. He stood and walked to the boxes, laid a hand on one in the top row.
It was a bad one all around, he said quietly.
I don't mean to be disrespectful.
Don's fine.
But can you give me a complete summary? I don't want you to think I'm looking for a shortcut here. I'm not opposed to going through every piece of paper in there twice, if the story calls for it. But first, I need to see if we can find a connection that justifies such an expense of time and effort.
A summary I can do.
Maybe start with the nickname.
Ah,
he said.
Weird how those work, isn't it? No one really picks a nickname, not even for a serial killer. It just floats out of the ether, and in just a matter of days we make some kind of collective unconscious decision. This is what we're going to call the son of a bitch.
It came from the ether? He kept talking without looking at her, almost to himself.
Or maybe it's just convenience. Gotta call him something. Can't just keep calling him the perp or the suspect. No, in a case that goes on long enough, you get kind of familiar with the person you're hunting. You might not know his face, but all the little details start to fit together like bricks in a wall. Until finally they've built something. Someone. You know him like an old friend. And he needs a name.
Is that really how you feel about him? Her voice snapped him back from whatever daydream he'd descended into. He shook it off and looked at her again.
Over the years, I've felt just about every emotion possible for a case like that. But the name thing? No, forget all that. I was just talking. After we found Susan Gilroy, the first girl in a field, we were all standing there looking down at her body. She was 9 years old, but she seemed smaller. After the things he did to her, she seemed very small indeed. She looked like a flower that had wilted and dried, like the slightest wind might blow her away.
He ran a hand down the stubble on his chin.
It was horrible. Real bad. Worst thing any of us had seen. And I said something like, are we gonna catch this guy? And one of the other guys there, some detective, I can't remember who, he looked down at her and said, we've got to. This kid is a real sick puppy. Or something similar. And that was it. That was all it took. A few cops started calling him the kid, and some days later we all were. Then it bled over into the papers. The rest history.
The kid, she said under her breath.
Stupid, right?
I don't know. It's better than something huge and over top. Better not to make him a boogeyman.
Could be, you're right,
he said, and started pulling down white banker's boxes. He arranged them in sequential order across the floor. He opened one.
Let's start with the last one, he said. Let's start with the Christmas angel.
Maria Mendelssohn, Laura said, recognizing the moniker from her reading.
That's right. December 25th, 1988.
There's almost no details about her in the papers.
No. We left them out that time.
She wanted to ask why, but decided to let him tell the story at his own pace.
That year was unseasonably cold for central North Carolina. And starting late on Christmas Eve, a rare snow fell. It was a good 4 or 5 inches, enough to lay a blanket on the world. Enough that when the Mendelssohns got up Christmas morning, they didn't immediately notice what was in their front yard.
He coughed, sipped his water.
There's an unusual shape under the snow, but it's hard to make out. It's next to a wide log, what was left of a downed tree from a few weeks earlier. Klaus Mendelssohn had been meaning to get to it, but it's at least 4 feet in diameter. A big job. In fact, he spends the early morning hours dragging brush from the parts he'd already cut near the top and shoveling his driveway.
Seems unnecessary, Laura said.
Around here? The snow probably would have melted inside of 48 hours. But Klaus was looking for something to occupy his hands and his mind. It wasn't a normal Christmas morning, you see. Their daughter Maria had been missing for 3 days. Where was she taken from? Was there any? Rogers cut her off. Just let me get through this, okay? Anyway, since he couldn't sleep, he'd been at it since dawn. At 10:30, he takes an early lunch break, goes into the house, eats with his wife. During that lunch, the low winter sun finally climbs up over the eave of the house and shines directly into the front yard. At 11:30, Mrs. Mendelson looks out the front bay window and starts screaming. Rogers shook his head. Never stopped screaming as far as I know. Old Klaus ended up sending her to an institution. Of course, he was never the same either. Hung himself before Christmas next. Laura leaned forward, queasy and mesmerized all at once. The object by the log, she said. The words came out so quiet, she almost couldn't hear herself. It was their daughter. What was left of her anyway? Someone had removed her nose and lips, perimortem, at another location. She was transported, pushed up against the log with her hands bound behind her. Then he cut into her like he was performing seppuku. Her intestines piled in her lap. He trailed off, gulped water, ran his shirt sleeve across his brow to stem the tide of sweat. It ran unchecked down the sides of his face. She was small enough, and the snow was just thick enough for it to cover up the details. It gave us a few clues, of course. We know it happened before the snow started. All the blood was covered, and there were no footprints other than Klaus's. No, she was perfectly concealed until the snow started to melt away. Laura tried to make herself focus, started mapping out a timeline in her notebook. So he kills her, brings her to the house, then... No, 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 Rogers rasped. He mutilated her. But she was still alive. She was alive when he placed her down next to the log. She was alive when he opened her up. Laura said nothing. She could see her own house. Do you understand that? Her parents didn't sleep much. Based on statements from Klaus Mendelson, he and his wife were in the front room from sunset onwards. In the front room, with the big bay window, curtains open, all the lights blazing. She could see them, Laura breathed. He wanted her to see them. Rogers squeezed his eyes shut. His nostrils trembled with every breath. Now you're getting it. All that little girl wanted to do, all any taken child would want, is to make it home. And this person, he waited until she was close enough to see it, hear it, almost touch it. Then he killed her. Only then. Jesus. And when you think about it, that's only the beginning. The kid spent the time and energy to bring her back. He risked someone seeing him, being identified, being caught. Everything, really. Just to create that frozen tableau. To what end? Laura shrugged. To give someone nightmares. Who knows what's going through his head? You say that like he's some kind of mystery, but as far as I'm concerned, your gut reaction is just right. He wanted her parents to see his little diorama. That's part of his game. Maybe it's the end goal.
What about the other two girls?
Rogers snorted. Practically routine compared to the last one. But there were similarities. The modus operandi, manual strangulation, the bodies discovered in fields around the county. The girls were bound with the same twine. It was twisted out of unusual bright colors. All three of them still had a loop on an ankle or a wrist. He sighed. But we could never find a match. I imagine your FBI fella has drawn the connection to Olive Hansen, using some or all of that.
Laura finished jotting in her notebook before looking back up, waiting for him to continue. Rogers scratched at his stubble, said nothing. Suspects? Other physical evidence? Theories? He shook his head slowly.
Never managed to get that far. You can go through every box if you want, read every piece of paper, but that's a pretty complete summary. I told you everything that matters. The rest is just a very large collection of dead ends.
Laura closed the notebook, stood, and surveyed the boxes one last time. So what's not in here?
Excuse me?
I'm not asking for anything official. So before you answer, understand I'm not recording your answer.
He nodded.
But come on, open up a little. I know there can't be any real evidence or anything else with proof to back it up, or it would have been important enough to run up the flagpole. I'm asking, what's not in the files? What are your personal opinions on all this? You've got to give me something, Don. Who do you think did it? He laughed, a bark cut off so sharply she thought it might mutate into a sob.
Who did it? Who did it? You're really asking me that?
She sat down again, leaned across the table, put her hand on his. I'm not expecting a revelation, but there must be something. He cracked the knuckles in his right hand, then his left.
My opinion?
Anything, she said.
Okay, we've dispensed with what I know. So here's what I think. It's not an outsider. It's someone who lives right here in Hillsboro.
Why?
Because the most important connection between all three girls, and between this new one, is that he displays them. Most killers, serial or otherwise, do one of two things upon completing a murder. One,
he ticked them off on his fingers.
They leave the body where it falls, recognizing that transporting it opens them up to being seen. Or two, they transport the body, intending to hide it. The kid does neither of those. He moves the body out into the open. At great personal risk, he displays them.
What does that mean?
You're a reporter. When you put together a story, you're writing for an audience, aren't you? You write about some fireman saving a puppy. You're trying to inject them with a little hero worship. You write about molestation. You want them to be appalled.
I don't understand.
He's writing for an audience, too. All of us.
Rogers gestured to the space around them.
And he wants to see the reactions to his work painted on our faces. I imagine it's sweet to him. How could he do that without living here, without walking among us?
I can't print anything without the evidence to back it up.
Good, he said. You print that and you'll set off a panic. Besides, I'd deny every word. But you can't have my files.
He walked her out to the car and helped her fill the trunk and backseat with boxes. When they were finished, Laura said, let me ask you, do you think it's the same killer? Do you think the kid took Teresa Mitchum?
Rogers shrugged. Neither of us is inside the investigation. But if the FBI sent you to talk to me, there has to be a reason.
What does your gut tell you? He fixed her with a look.
Maybe you didn't notice, but this whole time we've been talking about him, we've been using the present tense.
An icy finger slid up her spine.
You have a good day now, Miss Chambers. And please don't come back. I've been trying to forget this for almost 30 years. Now I've passed the torch to you. Consider it my final contribution.
Don't quit just yet, she said. But he was already up the stairs and back inside. Chapter 12. 2 miles east, just as the sun touched Highway 70 in a rearview mirror and pumped the sky full of purple, the needle on the Dart's gas gauge dropped into the E. Laura drifted the car down a rutted clay shoulder and into a gas station's cracked parking lot. As the tank was filling up, she walked around the corner of the building and pulled out her phone. Hello, Dr. Devane's office? It caught her off guard. Is Dr. Devane available?
Speaking.
Jasmine, it's Laura Chambers. What are you doing in the office on Saturday evening?
I could ask you a version of the same question, as in, what are you doing calling the office on a Saturday night? I didn't expect to get you, figured I'd leave you a voicemail. She could hear the doctor's sharp intake of breath. Laura, is this an emergency? A light bulb went off in Laura's head. She realized that the context, a therapy patient calling a therapist outside of business hours, implied she was having some kind of breakdown. Nothing like that. No, really, I mean it. I'm